All right. I'll call to order the Senate General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. Colleagues, today is Wednesday, February 5th, and we are convened for the purposes of a public hearing on Senate Bill 1518, a public hearing and possible work session on 1563, public hearing on Senate Bill 1567, and a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 1583. The order we will go in is that we will start off with Senate Bill 1563, then move on to 1567, then to 1518, and then to 1583. And 1583 has a subsequent referral to judiciary. I think we'll hear the testimony, hear the arguments, and make some decisions about where the committee would like to go once we hear the testimony. That being said, Chana, would you like to tee anything up for us?
Chair Shields, I think you have covered the outline very well, and if you'd like to gavel us into a public hearing on 1563, I'll tell you all about it.
All right. I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1563. Chana.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, 1563 comes to you from Senator Rosenbaum, Roblin, and Beyer. We have received a no fiscal impact statement and a no revenue impact statement. This measure would allow Business Oregon to make entrepreneurial development loans to small businesses up to the amount of $100,000. Currently, there is a $70,000 cap. There is a proposed -2 amendment before you, which inserts language promoting entrepreneurial development in rural communities and extending the length of the loan period from 5 years to 10 years.
Okay. Let's bring up Senator Rosenbaum and Senator Beyer. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. And for the record, I'm State Senator Diane Rosenbaum from District 21, which is in southeast and northeast Portland and Milwaukee and Oak Grove in Clackamas County. And I'm very pleased to appear in front of you today in support of Senate Bill 1563, which is a very simple bill that will do a lot of good for our small businesses that want to expand or get started in Oregon. And basically, as you know, Oregon's economy, which has been so challenged for so long, is very slowly starting to recover. And we have had some good news lately, including that our state now has the third fastest job growth rate of any state in the country. And so that's good news to see the unemployment figures coming down also is great. But we definitely need to do more, both in our cities and in the rural parts of Oregon, particularly to help small businesses that have had to struggle through good times and bad, but especially in the last few years during the economic downturn, have had huge challenges just to stay in business, let alone to be able to expand and hire more people when they need to. And what this bill is about is financing for those small businesses. So just to tell you briefly what the bill will do, we have an existing loan program. It's called the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund that is administered through our Business Development Department, and I think you will hear from them shortly too. And this is a program that's available for small businesses that want to get startup funds or expand. And what the bill does is take the cap on the amount that can be applied for, which is currently set at $70,000, and increase that to a total amount of $100,000. So, in other words, and I think you'll hear from some of the small businesses that would make use of this or have, it will increase the number of businesses that could apply, and it'll make it much more meaningful to those businesses. When we first started talking about this bill before we came into session this week, we did hear from small business owners around the state. I think one of them at least is here today. I talked to her and met her earlier out in the hall, and it's Evan Remington, who's the owner of a food processing company called Fresh and Local Foods right here in Marion County. And she'll tell you her story of what it's like to try to start a business and then expand it and how difficult access to capital continues to be. So this this bill, which just takes this program that has already provided since its inception over 54 individual loans at last count. This will probably increase the number of businesses that can apply, and even more will increase the oomph of what they can do with that money. And obviously, you know, as Senator George probably knows better than almost anybody on the committee, perhaps Senator Shields too, from having been involved in small business activities, small businesses are where the job growth needs to happen in our state and is the engine of our economy. And we think that, this bill is going to provide some much needed support. And it's also important to note that these loans have gone to counties around the state, not by any means concentrated just in the Willamette Valley, but I think that it's been something like 16 of our 36 counties where businesses have been successful at getting these funds. So it's definitely a statewide program. It's definitely money that immediately has gone to create more jobs, much needed jobs, and good jobs that both are people who are underemployed or still out of work need, and our small businesses are in a position to create that. I want to also mention that we do have a Dash 2 amendment. I think the committee administrator explained it earlier, but it's a very simple amendment that we're supporting. Significantly, what it does is increase the payback period for the loan, which is currently 5 years, to 10 years, and then add some language to the mission of the program. So essentially, it's a simple bill, but it will create jobs. It will help our Main Street businesses around the state. And I would just urge the committee to support it and hopefully be able to go into a work session and move it to the floor. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, Lee Beyer, State Senator from District 6, which is Lynn and Lane counties, portions of. The Senator Rosenbaum is, and your staff has kind of covered the details of this. And I think the key, one of the things I really liked about this is we were looking at it going into a special session where we all know we don't have a lot of money. And we went to Business Oregon, our Economic Development Department, and said, is there something out there that we can do, given the constraints we're facing, that would help? And they said, you know, we've got this small business program that we have quite a bit of demand for, but it's got some constraints in it. It's been around a long time. It's got some constraints. It's got a cap that's caused us to not be able to make a second round financing sometime. It's been required people to sort of lower their threshold of borrowing so that we couldn't do as much as we thought was logical on a business basis. You know, they're pretty good at this. They run a fairly large business profile. Our loan number of loan programs is just one of them. And this really gets at predominantly the small businesses, particularly the startup businesses, where it sort of fits into the old cliche that I've heard a lot from small businesses. If you go to get a loan and the banker tells you, well, you don't have the business background, so you know, if you need a loan, I'm not going to give it to you. But if you didn't really need a loan, then I'll give it to you. You know, it's kind of the nature of startup. You hear the stories a lot. I've worked with a lot of them who literally started up their business efforts by maxing out about a dozen credit cards at 18% to 24%. This is an alternative that I think is a good place. Again, you're going to hear from our business professionals who apply good lending practices and evaluating these, so it's not like we're throwing money away, given a chance. They're just making good business decisions. It's targeted a small number. It's a good effort. I think it's got a good track record. It's been around a while, like I say, and it's got a pretty good track record. Predominantly, it's been used in the rural areas of the state, so it's a nice effort.
All right. Good testimony. Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We bring up Evan Remington, please. Welcome to the committee.
Hi. Thank you, Chair Shields. I appreciate you listening to me and members of the committee. My name is Evan Remington. I live in West Salem and Polk County, and I own a business that is located in South Salem in Marion County. I started my company, Fresh and Local Foods, just about 7 years ago, and we've had to piece together financing all kinds of ways, through angel investors, through similar loan programs like this, and also self-financing, leveraging my home and credit cards and, you know, whatever we had to do to get our company off the ground and growing. 2 years ago, we were the recipient of a similar loan program through the city of Salem. At that time, I had 7 full-time employees. Now, just about exactly 2 years later, I've got 19 full-time employees and 3 part-time employees, and we continue to grow. Now it's starting to become a little bit easier, right, because we've got some good track record and some history and some actual financial data that goes back, so we can see some trends, and we've got some more sophistication around our reporting. But even still, I have bankers that say they want to give me a personal loan. They don't want to finance the business and what the needs of the company are. And frankly, I think for all entrepreneurs who are trying to start something and grow something and add value in our communities, that's a problem. But especially for those of us who are younger entrepreneurs who haven't yet had an opportunity to build a lot of the assets that a banker is looking for in order to, you know, essentially fully secure the debt. So it's not helpful for me to say, yep, we'll give you $30,000 when I just explained that we need $130,000. And they still want to wrap up, you know, all your equipment. So I can't speak any more highly of these types of programs, and how they've certainly been beneficial to us and our business. And it's very exciting to be somebody who can continue to grow and increase jobs in our community with the support of our public loan program. So thank you. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you for your testimony. I did want to give you a chance to do a little commercial for your...
Great.
What do you do?
Great, thank you. So Fresh and Local Foods is a food processing company, and predominantly we do school lunch programs throughout the state. So we've got 3 trucks on the road currently, 5 days a week, delivering all over the state. We do Boys and Girls Clubs, Head Starts, large school districts, and we sell our products and services to them. Also, our Wholesome Bakes, which are frozen multi-serve entrees to hospitals and retirement facilities. So we have a real commitment to increase the quality and the health of the food in our institutions, and also to source our food locally to have a positive economic impact.
That's great. Very well said. Great. Anything else? Thank you very much for coming down to
tell
your story.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I think we have some people from Business Oregon, Paul Grove and John Saris.
May I be dismissed?
Yeah, you can.
Okay,
be
thank you.
Thanks. Now, Paul, you know never to get in the way of a bill that's on its way to passage, right?
Chair Shields, you're absolutely correct, and we're just here to testify in support of the bill and answer any questions that you may have with respect to the program. The senators did an excellent job describing what it does.
And could you identify yourself?
For the record, Paul Grove with the Oregon Business Development Department.
Great testimony.
Yes. Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Saris. I'm the Business Services Manager at Business Oregon and oversee the administration of the program. And as Paul commented, the senators did a great job outlining what the bill would do in support of entrepreneurial development in the state, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you guys may have.
Okay. Senator George.
Jim, real quickly, can you give us a scope of how big is the fund? What utilization rate is it at right now? I mean, is it fully maxed every year, or are you guys finding a hard time getting people to qualify? What's the status of the program, and then what's its utilization?
Chair Shields, Senator George, members of the committee, the program currently has about $2 million out in loans that we've made. We have about $1.6 million of cash that we would have available to continue to make loans. The principal and interest comes back and recapitalizes back into the fund and then can be redeployed. Right now, from a demand side, we're seeing probably in the neighborhood of 15 to 20 transactions a year that come to us. We work very closely with the Small Business Development Center network statewide, who work with these businesses, evaluate their business plans, and refer them then to the state loan program. So from a demand side, we have sufficient capital to continue making loans, and we don't anticipate that this change would create such a run on the program that we'd be out of money anytime in the immediate future.
Okay. And Paul, as long as you're in front of me, I just want to tell you how much I appreciate the work that you've done for the small businesses in our neighborhoods.
Thanks.
Okay. So I'm going to close the... Nobody else is here to testify, right? I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1563 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1563. Senator George?
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 1563.
Senator George has moved the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 1563. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so move. Senator George?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1563 as amended by Dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved the Senate Bill 1563 with the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Timothy, would you please call the roll?
Senator Berkshire.
Excused?
Senator Bonin Sanderson.
Aye.
Senator Pazowski.
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Chair votes aye. Bill is on its way to the floor. Carriers, do we have anything?
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Beyer?
Okay. Yeah, why don't we do co-carriers, Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Beyer? Okay. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1563 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1567. Chana.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1567 comes to you from the Governor's Office. Currently, a management service employee who is removed or reassigned for lack of work or reorganization may return to their previously held classified position. Senate Bill 1567 limits the time in which the management service employee may return to the classified service position. If that person was in service prior to January 1, 2015, then they have a restoration right of 3 years. If the employee returns, or if the employee enters management service after January 1st of 2015, there is no restoration right. Additionally, the measure creates an appeals process within the Department of Administrative Services.
All right. And I see Senator Edwards is here. Senator Edwards, would you like to come testify?
If it pleases the chair, I'd go after the department.
Okay. Mike Jordan and Clyde Seike. Welcome to the committee, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Michael Jordan. I'm the state's chief operating officer and the director at the Department of Administrative Services. I'd just like to briefly discuss what we've been doing to get to this point that the bill is before you and what it does. And then I'd like to hand it off to Mr. Seike to talk a little bit about some issues at the agency level about these the issues that the bill addresses. So, the bill basically has two component parts. The first is an attempt to, as was described, an attempt to reconcile an agreement that was come to at the bargaining table with labor this last cycle to amend the restoration right process that currently management service employees have. It, as was stated, limits that restoration right for current employees in management service to 3 years, and then ultimately removes that right in the future after this calendar year. That right would remain for employees who are in trial service still. So typically when someone promotes into or moves into management service, there's a trial service period, usually a year. So during that year, if the employee were not to continue in management service, they would have a restoration right back to management or to classified service. We obviously are in support of that bill, those parts, because we negotiated those at the table with labor. The other part of the bill also amends or attempts to amend a part of Chapter 240, which has to do with an appeal process for management service employees. Currently, in statute, that appeal process is to ERB, and that process takes a fairly significant amount of time, usually 6 months or more. It is an issue that time frame and the cumbersomeness of that process is an issue that tends to inhibit us from dealing with some of the issues that we should be dealing with, quite frankly, when it comes to some of our employees. To give you a sense of scale, there is somewhere in the vicinity of 50-ish management service appeals that go to ERB per biennium now. We've had a slight uptick in the number of appeals since we've been implementing House Bill 2020 and House Bill 4131, which are the management to employee ratio bills, if you'll recall. We've been doing a lot of work in agencies to either reclassify or eliminate or merge management positions. That's created a little uptick in the number of appeals that we've been seeing at ERB. We believe, as the bill states, that we can create a process that is more efficient and more expeditious, which we think actually benefits everyone in the process, but particularly our ability to hold our managers accountable and to get to outcomes and to do their jobs appropriately. We think it would be an improvement in the overall process. I will say one part of the bill requires the department to establish rules for that process, how that process will actually work. I will tell you that we are having still discussions about that process, and it is likely that we would be coming to you with some alterations to that bill. So with that, I can turn it over to Mr. Psyche.
Good to see you again.
Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Psyche from the Oregon Department of Transportation. So let me speak first on the restoration rights part of the bill. And for both parts of the bill, what I want to do is kind of share with you kind of the impact on the ground level and what happens at the agencies as we work through these two processes. So for the restoration rights, the way that system is currently set up, as long as you have had prior classified service, you have return rights, no matter how long you've been a manager, back to that prior classified position. So using myself as an example, if I were to be removed from my position, I would have return rights to a contracts officer position at the Department of Human Services that I last held, I believe, in 1990, and would be displacing a much more qualified person who, you know, is current on all the rules, regulations, and intricacies of writing contracts. And what that also would precipitate is potentially some bumping within the unit. And anyone who has ever been through a bumping process under the current collective bargaining agreements know it's very disruptive to the workplace, and the ripple effect is very destructive. So the other part of it that makes it difficult sometimes, we have actually had situations where when a manager is removed, the prior classification that they had prior to being promoted to management service no longer exists. It had been abolished along the way, and so then the agency has to find the best match, and we still face exactly the same issues I spoke to earlier about displacing employees and then potentially bumping within the agency. So that's on the restoration part. On the management appeal rights, agencies were very interested in making sure that there's a third-party review and that people are treated fairly and that we're making the right decision, the best decision possible. What we struggle with under the current system is really the time it takes to get final resolution to a situation. And during that time period, which potentially could be typically a year to 18 months, and our experience is more towards the 18-month period than the year period. We have had cases that have gone on for 2 years. During that time period, the agency then has to deal with the workload that the person who has been removed left in the agency. And we have several options. One is to try to absorb the workload within current management staff, which is a little more difficult now because with House Bill 4131, we've reduced the number of managers in state government so we can meet our span of control targets. And so it's very hard to absorb workload now because we have less managers. We can put an interim manager in the position, but having somebody in an interim role for 18 months or 2 years is difficult. Or we can choose to fill the position. But if we fill the position, and we're overturned by ERB, then the person comes back and we have to find a position to place that person in. So it's really about some of the timelines we have to face and the difficulty of managing our programs as we're working through the process. And I would also add that if someone makes an appeal to ERB and isn't successful, nothing precludes them from then going into civil court, which means now we're looking at a timeline of probably 4 to 5 years before we get final resolution. So with that, let me stop, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So, Mike, do you know, let's say you've got 50 open cases in front of ERB in a biennium, do you have any sense of how often the management employee prevails?
My sense from the numbers I've seen, and again, just preliminary numbers, is that about 10% of the time, maybe slightly less, the employee prevails, at least the numbers I've seen. And those aren't long histories, probably within the last biennium.
But you feel pretty confident, close to 10%, give or take?
Ish, yeah.
Okay, all right. And in these instances, they're no longer on the job, so you're just distributing the workload, and they're sitting at home. But you got to potentially bring them back into that position should they prevail. Is that the concern?
If they're reinstated, yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Okay, well, this one is not ready to go yet. When did you anticipate that it would need any amendments at this point, or do you think it's good to go?
I believe we need at least one for sure, okay. And that is that there was we left out an issue on the reinstatement that if a management service person is removed for cause, they would lose the reinstatement right, and so we need to get that in the bill. Somehow we didn't get that clause in there, so that's one for sure.
Okay.
Again, I think we're still discussing this. The characteristics of the appeal process we would construct, and we may have further amendments to bring you in a dash one.
All right, good. I mean, I think the ERB part of it seems to be a big change, and mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. that might not be special session might not be the best place to do that. So, but I do want to wrestle with this, figure out, you know, where what the rest of my colleagues think about it as well.
So. Mr. Chairman, we'll be in communication with you regarding those.
Okay. Great. And, Ms. Senator Edwards, right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to testify on this relatively obscure bill in the scope of big issues. For the record, my name is Chris Edwards, state senator from Eugene and Junction City, and I came upon this issue in the 2009 legislative session when I was serving in the House, and an employee of the executive branch, who shall remain nameless because they brought this issue to me in confidence, said that they really felt like this was a big problem. This is speaking specifically to the management service employee dismissal issue and that part of this bill. And so myself and Representative Clem drafted a bill that legislative session that was a fairly blunt instrument at the time, and just said, okay, well, you know, management service employees ought to be at will. And it had the relating clause in that bill was relating to public employees, and that caught all sorts of people's hair on fire, given that contract negotiations were underway and everything, and that bill was quickly assigned to the trash bin for that legislative session. But I never forgot about the issue and have continued to look into it, and in subsequent sessions have drafted other bills and done a little bit of research on the issue, and last legislative session, in fact, had a bill and then agreed to stand down on it pending negotiations that were happening with DAS and the reclassification process that they're going through. But I don't want to pass on the opportunity to push on why I think that this is important overall. I think our agencies, our departments in the state of Oregon have a responsibility first and foremost to our constituents, to serving the public. And I think our departments do that best. Any organization serves their customers the best when you have productive, happy work teams. And a key to that is good management. And when you have a manager that is not a good manager, and let's face it, not everybody's meant to be a manager, it shouldn't take 12 to 18 months to replace that person so that the employees can get on with the job at hand and serving their customers. So just as a management philosophy, I have great concern with the current ERB process. I know this bill would certainly change that dramatically, although much less dramatically than it could be changed. This does not make the management service employees at will. It does not mean that they serve only at the pleasure of the governor. So if this bill did that, they could essentially be dismissed for no cause. So this bill would maintain the statutory reasons that would establish cause for which they could be dismissed, but would change the appeal process and would streamline that process significantly. Personally, I think that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing for the taxpayers of Oregon. I think it's a good thing for the employees of the relative agencies and departments, and for the customers they serve. And frankly, it's been my experience that if an employee, say a management employee, is not in a good fitting position, while they may not feel like it's in their best interest in the long term, I would argue that you're not really doing them any service either in continuing their employment in a position that is just not a good fit. So for those reasons, I strongly support this bill and moving forward. I also brought legislation last session about the restoration rights piece, agreed to stand down pending the labor negotiations that were happening. Certainly support those as well. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for considering the bill this legislative session. I understand that you, from what you just said, it may or may not move in February. If it doesn't, I will be back next legislative session, and I'm not going home until it does move. So
there.
So, conversely, if we pass the bill, will you go away?
On this issue, you have my word.
Thanks, Chris. All appreciate right. it.
Thank you.
As I mentioned, even if we wanted to move it today, we the bill is not ready because we don't have the paperwork. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1567, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1518. Chana, tee it up for us.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1518 comes to you from Senator Courtney. It will modify the definition of supervisory employees under the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act to exclude firefighters who assign, transfer, or direct work of other employees, but who do not have the authority to hire, discharge, or impose economic discipline on other employees. The firefighters would then be eligible to organize or continue with union membership. The committee heard a very similar bill in 2013. That was House Bill 2418.
Thank you. And I particularly appreciate that, we don't have 100 people signed up to testify, and I'm grateful for that. This committee has heard a lot of this testimony before, and this bill has been modified, and we'll see if it... where the support might lie at that point. Bob Livingston.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council.
And while I certainly appreciate the diligence of Senator Edwards, I think he's got a few more years to go as far as being diligent as it relates to working a piece of legislation. I'm proud to be in front of you today.
Mr. Livingston,
yes.
Your notes are coming out of your pocket.
You don't like my notes?
I thought you might need them.
You're on camera.
I don't know what I need for high camera. Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 1518 certainly has been an issue. This is a veteran committee. You've heard it before. So I'm going to try to be as brief as I can as it relates to why this bill is needed, some of the safeguard employers have in the bill, and then wrap up with hopefully urging you to move this piece of legislation forward. Before I do that, though, from a technical standpoint, I have been asked, and just for clarification and to put on the record, if you look at page 4 of the bill as it relates to the bold language, specifically to nurses, I have checked with legislative counsel, and that is simply a retabulation. And the reason for that is that in construction of that, it flows better. And to reinforce that, if you look at lines 13 through 15 of the bill, you can note that the italicized deleted language in the paragraph is simply reinserted and retabulated in A. So as legislative counsel has noted to me, they would be happy to communicate that to you as well, Mr. Chair. This bill in no way changes the law for nurses. And I know that that is appreciated by many folks in the hospital administration. With that, why is Senate Bill 1518 needed? For the firefighters, we believe this is an issue of fairness and good public policy. You've heard me say this before, but one of the first things that happens in the fire service, when a new fire chief's hired, they either enter into a contract with a city manager and negotiate a contract with a city manager, or do that with representatives of fire district board. We think that many lead workers, such as the ones that would be included in Senate Bill 1518, deserve the same right. Also, if you look at the cadre of the workforce, I believe the firefighters are much similar to your electricians, plumbers, trade unionists. If you go to Intel right now and talk to the building trades, there's up to 2,000 union workers out there at that site. Almost all of them are union workers, whether that's the most intelligent and lead electrician that's dealing with huge complex issues. That person has a right to a union contract. If you're a lead worker or even a low-level lead worker in a large organization in the fire service, you don't have that right to a contract. I think it's important to also note, as it relates to fairness, and emphasize to you that in years past, you're going to hear a lot of negatives of what this bill may or may not do. I'll point to a couple of things on that. One, we've heard the same thing about when we passed cancer presumption and how that was going to bankrupt workers' comp system. That hasn't came to fruition. We heard about how Senate Bill 400, when we passed language to give public safety officers the right to bargain over safety, and how that's going to require 5 firefighters on each apparatus and 2 police officers in each vehicle. Those things simply haven't came to fruition. So my point is to that is in most instances, I'm happy and pleased to report that our union, as well as for that matter, the fire chiefs, we spend a great deal of time, energy, and resources on a collaboration, whether it's health and wellness initiatives or labor management initiatives. We do a lot of that. However, this is an area where we're simply going to disagree because it comes down to a couple of things. One, that issue of fairness, and then those issues of public policy, which I would like to speak to next. Certainly, in my 20-plus years in the fire service, since the passage of Senate Bill 750, when there was a change in how they define who is a supervisor for who's eligible to be in the bargaining unit, we've seen a deleterious effect on those people that are willing to promote up through the ranks. You know, the fact is, I hear from firefighters throughout the state, and hey, how's it going? You know, they can be a 15, 20-year veteran, have the experience, the skill set, the tools necessary to do their job. They get to a certain level, and they simply don't promote. When asked, why do they do that? I won't do that because I need the protections of a union. I need a contract. I think it's an issue of fairness. And you hear that. Why is that important for the fire service? Some of these positions that I'm talking about as lead workers also are the ones that make decisions on the fire ground. They make decisions at the fire station and deal with those. While they don't have the ability to hire or fire, impose economic discipline, they are lead workers. However, not having a contract is a sensitive issue, certainly in these economic times, and while we're coming out of it, they don't promote up through the ranks because of the inherent dangers of that jobs and some of those things that you get when you have a labor contract. So one could argue, and I would certainly argue, it's a social compact, but it's also important to successor planning. What happens in these organizations, whether you're large or small, clearly, let's face it, the more qualified candidates that you have with the right skill set to be, you know, either lead workers and then hopefully up through the ranks as executive officers, those are the people you want. Simply, the competition's not there. And I think all I would point to in previous years on an issue that fortunately we're not talking a lot about during this session, in some of the legislation that we've seen brought forward by some of the stakeholders on the other side. And I would point to, you know, in years past, the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association has lobbied this legislative body on exemptions to the 1039 PERS rule. And one of the arguments they make is we're having a hard time finding good executive fire chiefs to do the job here in Oregon. So I think there is a problem, even though you've heard that they say there's not a problem in these. I would beg to differ with that. It's finally, the final point from a public policy is safety. You know, to have good people in these ranks, you know, it makes the job safer. We want bright, well-educated individuals. I heard Mr. Jordan talk about that. And I think it's extremely important that your public safety officers are well-trained, well-managed, and have the skill sets. I truly believe that this small tweak in legislation will promote good public policy so that we have enough qualified candidates move up through the ranks. The second point I would make before I close, Mr. Chair, is there's many employer protections in this bill. Not only in the bill, but in the law. If you point to 243650 6, confidential employee, and I'll read a quote. Confidential employee means one who assists and acts in a confidential capacity to a person who formulates, determines, and effectuates management policies in the area of collective bargaining. Well, what does that mean in layman's terms? That means that if you're in a position where you are deemed to be a confidential employee, it doesn't matter how we change the definition of supervisory. If you're a confidential employee, you are automatically deemed to be a manager and ineligible to be in a bargaining unit. There's not a fire chief in the state that doesn't either effectuate or assist or you know, have input in whether it comes to a grievance, whether it comes to settling the contract with their people. So those that want to say, hey, our fire chiefs are going to be in that, that's simply not true by the law. And that would also include many of their executive officer levels. One thing to point out, why this bill is written the way it is, titles are varying in public safety, and they particularly vary in the fire service. What a lieutenant does in City A may be entirely different than what a lieutenant does in City D. And so that's why we focus more on definitions and not on titles. Another safeguard that employers still have, Division 25 of the Employment Relations Board, which oversees the PECBA laws here for public employees in the state of Oregon. If there's a unit clarification, those members don't automatically go into the bargaining unit. Not only would it provide for a process, and does it under Rule 25, where there's a unit clarification, once that's determined whether those people are appropriate for the bargaining unit, those individual employees that are affected by that change must then have a 30% vote of interest to say, hey, we want to be part of that union. And then further from that, there has to be 51% by secret ballot wanting to join that union. Finally, I think if you look at the fiscal impact statement, by the fact that this bill is indeterminate in what the cost of it is, and it says in there, and this is not directly a quote, but pretty close to it, it says it depends on how employers elect to handle this bill. And like I've pointed out to this committee and others before throughout the years, employers ultimately have the ability to determine who are managers. Give them the authority to hire, give them the authority to fire, give them the authority to impose economic discipline, allow them to be a confidential employee. You know, there's a process in place through Rule 25 of VERB, and the list goes on. So what we're really talking about is, one, if you believe that firefighters should be treated equally like electricians, plumbers, and others that have a contract, then I think you certainly should be supportive of this bill. This is not going to be something that changes the earth. This is a very modest bill. We hope that it can pass so we can move on to other issues. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak once again about this issue that's a priority issue for the firefighters, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate your testimony. Can we bring up Ted Coons and Kyle McMahon, please?
Good afternoon. My name is Ted Coons. I'm Fire Chief and Chief Executive Officer of the Canby Fire District, and I'm also the President of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. I'm here today to speak to you about Senate Bill 1518 and why we're opposed to that bill. Rightfully so, Oregon firefighters are well-protected public servants. They need to be. They put their lives on the line every day for what they do. They do a fantastic job, probably with not all the resources they need out in their communities. But one of the ways that we protect our firefighters is in employment. And some of that falls into civil service. Currently, firefighters are protected under ORS 242, civil service for firefighters. It also speaks to school teachers and so forth like that, all in the same section. It includes firefighters of all ranks, up to the rank of fire chief. But the fire chief is the only position that can be excluded from civil service. It'd be my contention that if there's only some protection in place, then why would we move forward and why do we need this bill? If there's a question in regards to whether an employee should be included in a collective bargaining agreement, then that question is forwarded to the Employment Relations Board, and Bob just spoke to that. ERB is a protocol in place to review the facts and makes a determination on whether or not certain classification of employee belongs in the bargaining unit or not. In the fire service, this has been a little-used system, but has been shown not to be broken. So my question again is, what are we trying to fix? In the past, when we've appeared before you on this or other labor-related issues, it's been an event or some research. I'll give an example of cancer. While the first time cancer came around, we were opposite with the union on that one. But when it came around the next time, we'd reached a compromise about what scientific data we could all buy into. So there's data to support that position. And we've gone together to make the case for those changes. But that's not the case today. 1518 is not needed. It's redundant and creates a fast track around a protocol at ERB that has served all parties fairly over the years. And thank you for your time, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
And thank you, by the way, for your help on the restoration bill.
No problem, sir.
Welcome to the committee.
Chair Shields, committee members, my name is Kyle McMahon. I'm a battalion chief with Marion County Fire District Number 1 here in Salem, Oregon, and I'm here to speak in opposition of House Bill 1518. For our organization, the battalion chief represents the top level of supervision and management that is still assigned to shift work. Most of our battalion chiefs work alongside our firefighters on a day-to-day basis. I am trained as both an operations battalion chief and a finance battalion chief. I also serve as a chief financial officer and serve on the negotiating bargaining team representing management. During the course of a typical shift, the battalion chief is responsible for the conduct, evaluation, supervision, and discipline of all of our response personnel. Our battalion chiefs have no desire to be part of the bargaining unit, and in fact, we believe it would represent a significant deterioration of our management team. Currently, our management team consists of four battalion chiefs, an assistant chief, and our fire chief. If our battalion chiefs were placed into the bargaining unit, we would effectively lose one half of our management team, including myself as the chief financial officer. In our organization, it is very common for a battalion chief to initiate the majority of the preliminary components of personnel investigations, which we obviously would have a conflict if we were part of the bargaining unit. Thank you for your time. Be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Senator Przanski.
Thanks. Gentlemen, Bob testified, and y'all, I guess, get your perspective on this. The part that he says on his testimony is what the bill will not change, and he goes into the classification or identification of a confidential employee. First of all, are you confidential employees?
I, as fire chief, am. Yes, and so are my division chiefs.
Okay. So if I heard Bob's testimony correctly, and this is one of the things, I mean, I've been here for many of these discussions, it seems like since 95, which was my very first session, when the major shift and change occurred, if I remember correctly, I think it was SB 750. Okay, but what it was is what it is now is, what are we fighting over? I mean, if you're a confidential employee and you can't be a part of a bargaining unit, what is the issue about how it's going to impact your ability to do your job, and they can have what I'm going to say was the law prior to 95 change?
Well, the big part is that with management employees, it all depends on what agency you work for. They're, you know, Portland, for an example, their battalion chiefs, which are their first level managers, are in the union. And that was an agreement that was made between those employees and the employer. In other places, the management employees, it's not like they're all left out to dry and they have no representation. I know my organization, Marion County, where Kyle works, those employees are all covered by work agreements, just like a regular employee is, or a union employee would be. But they don't have the ability to be a part of the bargaining unit. So most employers are taking care of their people. This isn't a big problem that management employees in the fire service are being left out. And actually, I disagree with Bob in one thing, in the fact that when we go out and we recruit for positions in management, we don't have any trouble getting anybody to fill those spots. It's not like we're out having to beat the bushes for mid managers or entry level managers to come in.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Scott Winkles and Hasina Squires.
For the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in opposition to this legislation. We're opposed to this bill for several reasons, and I'm going to try to limit my testimony to the high points. And first, one of the major stumbling blocks in this bill is it doesn't adequately define what we mean by economic discipline. Because I think it can be reasonably argued that a permanent letter placed in a file could have a negative economic impact on an employee. And I believe that has been argued through the grievance process, and there's probably some herb cases on that. So we haven't really discussed what do we mean by economic discipline. Is it to suspend, to demote, to terminate, or is it a negative performance evaluation that impacts somebody's ability to promote or might have a negative impact on their ability to find employment elsewhere if they were to flunk a background investigation. So that's very unclear in this bill, and I think it is to implementation. I think that would be a significant stumbling block. Additionally, we're only talking about one type of definition of a supervisor. There are other reasons and other governmental entities they're going to look at these employees and determine what their supervisor status is. I want to draw your attention. There was a Supreme Court case in July of 2013, and it was, I believe it was Vance versus Ball State University, where the Supreme Court narrowed what they view as a supervisory employee in terms of a harassment case. And this is where it gets really tricky for employers, is that when a supervisory employee, as determined through usually the equal opportunity employment process or through a civil suit, supervisor employee commits an act of harassment or has knowledge of an act of harassment, that liability is inherent, that employer has liability for that action. If a supervisor knows something happened, the employer knows something has happened, they are liable. And this is where things get even trickier, is that under this bill, if we have a supervisory employee who has knowledge of harassment, and say the victim, which happens more frequently than it should, the victim asks that they not take action, the supervisor is now, the employer is now liable. There's no magic word that a victim needs to say when they're harassed. If knowledge is the key. So if a supervisor has knowledge, they don't act, as does happen occasionally, this employer is liable. If the employer then takes disciplinary action against that supervisor, we're now subjecting that disciplinary decision to a binding arbitration process. So we have lost the control over who our supervisors, who our agents are, and that is a significant concern for us. Additionally, the The bill puts employers in a very difficult position, is that economic discipline rests, generally speaking, at the highest, if we're talking about suspension and termination, demotion, that rests at the highest level of an organization, typically at the chief. Sometimes, and some of my members, their charters actually require that the city manager impose that level of discipline. We take it that seriously. So we either allow our managers into a bargaining unit or subject them to a unit clarification process, which I'll get into in just a second, or do we shift that authority down the chain of command in order to keep our management teams intact and maintain control over who our managers, who our leaders, and who our agents are in the agency? And that's going to be a very difficult decision. And I don't know. I think it'll be a mixed bag across Oregon cities as to which decision that they're going to make. I don't think either of those choices are particularly are good public policy. I think the way the system works now is good. It's working well. The last part, and I'm going to disagree with some of the testimony earlier, is that when we read the administrative rules that the ERB uses in determining unit clarification processes, there's the rule that specifically calls out the supervisory statute does not require a showing of interest, and it does not guarantee the right to an election. And keep in mind, it is ERB that determines what method of unit clarification is going to take place. It's not the bargaining unit, it's not the employer or the filer. It is the ERB, and so the rule that specifically calls out that supervisory statute, as well as the confidential and the managerial statute, there's no right to an election, and it does not require a showing of interest. And so, employee choice, as you heard from the earlier panels, is critical in our view. And we have seen instances where employees who were subjects to a unit clarification process attempted to intervene in the process, and that was objected to by the bargaining unit. So that is a concern. We know it's happening. And lastly, the ERB itself, they're not funded at a level to handle their current workload. They're not traveling. The Ministry of Law judges aren't traveling. They've improved the timelines on their decisions. That's largely due to a change of who's on the ERB. But they're still not, the legislature has not adequately funded this agency commensurate with their current workload. We're going to see numerous unit clarifications should this bill pass. And that's going to have ripple effects through the entire process, through all those PECBA employers, because we're going to be clogging the system with these, and each unit clarification can cost as much as $10,000 in legal fees and representation costs. And with that, I will close my testimony and turn it over to my colleague.
Great. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Shield, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hosina Squires, and I'm here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, a trade association made up of local governments. There are approximately 900 special districts throughout the state of Oregon. Our largest type of district that belongs to special districts are rural fire protection districts, and there are approximately 275 within our association. I'm here today in opposition of Senate Bill 1518. The bill would redefine supervisory employees in strike-prohibited labor unions. As you know, disputes about whether an employee qualifies as a supervisor are handled by ERB. They have statutory criteria that dictates their decisions that include things like independent judgment, recommending employment actions, and exercising significant authority. We do not believe that the current law has resulted in employees being unfairly excluded from the bargaining unit. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and you have my written testimony, which is more extensive. And I appreciate the ability to appear before you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Questions? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Let's see. Can we bring up Mike Dyke? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Dyke, and I'm the fire chief of Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. I'm not here in opposition of the bill. Instead, I'm here to acknowledge the helpfulness of the definition of supervisory employee in the statute. It gives a clear delineation of who is and who is not a supervisor in the fire service. If enacted, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and as I would presume, other fire departments throughout the state will engage in an internal process to analyze the middle management positions and determine the scope of responsibilities. And with this statutory definition, that is very helpful. I am happy to respond to any questions you might have.
Good testimony. Questions? Thank you very much for coming forward with that. I would like to bring up Mike Tedesco. If there seemed to be some basic disputes in the bill, and Mike, I wanted to see if you might be able to clarify some things from your perspective.
Thank you, Chairman Shields, members of the committee. My name is Mike Tedesco. I serve two masters. I teach labor relations law at the University of Oregon Law School and labor arbitration, and I also represent public and private sector employees, in addition to, I'm proud to say, a vast majority of the firefighter locals in the state. I've done numerous unit clarifications, and I just responding to what I've heard, the words management employee and supervisory employee being tossed around like there's no difference. There is a difference. If you look at the current composition of the law, a supervisory employee is excluded from a bargaining unit for fire and fire districts and municipalities. A management employee is not. The management definition only applies to state workers in terms of the exclusion, and that was changed in Senate Bill 750 back in 1995. So when witnesses testify, well, we're going to include management employees, quote unquote, they're already there. So that I think we need to be a little more precise with our language. A couple of other issues. It was raised by one of the gentlemen that there's civil service. Well, there's civil service for fire districts. And that civil service, and fire districts and not municipalities, I might add, and that civil service is a vague general rule. It provides no inherent job protection for low-level managers, low-level supervisors, if you will, depending upon where they fall on that line, who are discharged or receive economic discipline. And while we're on that subject, economic discipline is indeed very well defined. Economic discipline triggers the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. It triggers a property right. And it triggers, it basically would mean in the context of the fire service, anyone who is terminated, demoted, or suspension. Getting a written reprimand or a verbal reprimand or a letter of concern is not economic discipline in the fire service. Now, my good dear friend, Kyle McMahon, who testified from Marion County a few minutes ago, I think it's instructive to hear what he said. He's a battalion chief at Marion County. He's a good one. But what did he say? I'm on our bargaining team. That makes him a confidential employee. Kyle couldn't be in the bargaining unit whether he wanted to or not, because the definition of a confidential employee isn't somebody who keeps secrets. I mean, that's, you know, kind of what it makes sense. But in fact, what it means is you're keeping employer collective bargaining secrets. And Kyle, by virtue of being on the management bargaining team, is clearly doing that. So he couldn't be in under the definition that the firefighters are proposing here. There was just a couple of other issues. One was the concern about EEO claims. Frankly, that's mind-boggling. As an employer in the state of Oregon, public or private sector, you are responsible for what your employees do in the course and scope of their employment, whether they be management employees, supervisory employees, or regular employees. So if you have a bargaining unit employee sexually harassing a member of the public or another bargaining unit employee, using that example, the employer is still liable for the activities of that employee. Their status within the bargaining unit makes absolutely no difference. In other words, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commissioner or the State Bureau of Labor and Industries isn't going to check to say, well, you're in a union, so I guess that you know, the employer's off the hook with respect to you. That's fanciful. That's just not true. The fire departments in this state are unique organizations. They're paramilitary organizations. They tend to be run from the top down. And there's lots of good reasons for that. Most, virtually all, fire chiefs that I've dealt with in my 35 years of representing firefighters maintain very closely their right to impose economic discipline. And they do that for a reason, because the buck stops with them. It's a rare fire chief that will delegate that authority anywhere below the level of perhaps an assistant chief. And I've done hundreds, literally hundreds, of firefighter discipline cases in my career. And I can count on one hand the number of times economic discipline was imposed below the level of an assistant chief. And in the vast majority of those cases, it was the fire chief. Now, one of the concerns also expressed was that ERB would get a flood of cases. Well, you know, the reality is that's just not the case, because what this language does is it takes the uncertainty out of the law, where there is currently uncertainty in the law. This gives, as I think as Chief Dyke just mentioned, a very clear, bright line definition of who could be in and who could be out. Currently, the area of quote-unquote assignments is all over the board. The NLRB has changed position on this dozens of times. ERB has gone back and forth on that issue. This will clear that up. We will have less cases and not more. And so I don't think we need to fear that quite as much as it's frankly being hyped here. So with that understanding, and I could go on, and I'm sure you don't want me to. Every once in a while I think I'm in the classroom and I've got 3 hours, you know. So, but thank you for your time, committee members, and if you have any questions, please.
Thank you for your testimony. We're going to see where this goes. It's not ready to go today, even if we wanted to. So I will close the public hearing, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1583. Chana.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1583 was sponsored by Senator George and Senator Shields. It establishes a prohibition on state officers, local governments, school districts, any public agency from collecting location data that is obtained from a cell phone or communication device. It also prohibits the collection of a person's web browsing history, email, social media accounts, etc. And it provides an exemption in certain emergency circumstances and establishes a procedure for requesting a warrant for the protected information. You do have the proposed -2 amendments, which have a lot of changes to the bill.
Senator George, did you want to testify on
sure.
this?
Okay. Chair Shields, I would like to add that this has a subsequent referral to the Senate Committee on Judiciary.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Larry George, State Senator from Senate District 13. To my right is still Steve Elzinga, who is from the Senate Republican office. He did some technical things. The Senate Republican office doesn't have any position on this bill, but he'd helped with some technical insight. He'll walk through the bill really quick for us, and then I'll kind of talk about some of the policy issues.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Elzinga. I work for the Senate Republican office. As he said, the caucus is not taking position on this bill, but I have been working on some of the technical issues. This bill is modeled after similar laws that recently passed in Maine and Montana relating to the cell phone tracking portions, and then a similar law that passed in Texas relating to the electronic data portions. Notably, those laws, at least the Montana and Maine laws, are significantly more strict than this one. This bill has a number of exceptions that are not contained in those laws. Basically, the format of the bill is that in Section 3, or Section 2, which talks about cell phone tracking, it starts off by saying that a public agency or a public body may not obtain cell phone location information without a warrant. And then it goes through and specifies this normal warrant requirements plus a list of exceptions for things like consent, emergency circumstances, risk of death or injury to a person, etc. Then it also contains a notice requirement that says that within 3 days of a public agency obtaining cell phone location information, they must notify the person who they got the information about. But then it also has an exception that's pretty broad for any situation where, for example, an investigation is ongoing and they don't want to notify a person for fear of that person escaping or something like that. Section 3 lays out, has a very similar structure that applies in situations of personal electronic data. So that would be information on your email account, on your web browsing history, your cable watching history, etc. The Dash 2 amendments before you fix some of the concerns that were raised by the Department of Justice and the Salem Police Department, I want to be clear, it does not fix all of the concerns they have raised because discussions are still ongoing, but it addresses what we view as the most significant, and we look forward to hearing their additional suggestions for improvement.
Colleagues, I think that all of us have taken note of the issue of privacy, especially when we hear the initial impact of Edward Snowden, and people were had a kind of blasé attitude towards it, and then when we actually realized how much scrutiny our private data is going under by our federal government, there started to be a great deal of concern by constituencies all over this country. But you probably heard about your own constituents in your district. People are very concerned about what government is doing as far as tracking, keeping data, all of those things on completely innocent Oregonians and Americans. And so the concept of this bill came forward, and of course, looking at the Maine and Montana examples, which I will submit to the committee administrator, I think what we see is that there's a huge need to actually have some boundaries. And rather than trying to have a public relations snafu where a public agency goes too far and then it's really embarrassing for the state, I think it's really important for the legislature as a policy to set out the boundaries of what we think is appropriate. And then if changes are needed in those boundaries, different public agencies could come forward and say, hey, we need this adjustment or that adjustment. But it's really, really important that we jump out ahead of this issue and get out there and say, okay, this is what we see as acceptable behavior by our public bodies as far as tracking, keeping information, databasing private information on our citizens. Just a responsible step in the right direction. This is one of those things, just because the technology is changing so fast, this is one of those areas of law that will be dynamic in the future. And people who have been criticized, critical of this bill being introduced are like, oh, it's happening too fast. And the reality is that these things are happening very fast, and agencies are using technologies at their disposal, and we don't have a public policy in place to actually govern them. And what they're doing is they're writing their own policies inside their agencies or inside. And really, this is one of those areas that is so fundamental that really it is something that the state legislature should have in state law with a policy, and these issues and the boundaries are set tightly, and then as we expand those boundaries, though, each one of those expansions is discussed in a public policy way before the legislature. As Steve mentioned, the Dash 2 amendments are our first attempt to address some of the concerns. Obviously, it's complex. With the original draft of Senate Bill 1583 and the subsequent Dash 2 amendments, they're both much stricter than the Montana or the Maine actual laws that passed. But we're trying to be proactive and try to get as many people engaged. As Committee Administrator mentioned, it has a subsequent referral to Judiciary, and obviously that's going to be where it's going to be worked at an additional level, whether that's in this session or whether it's in the next general session. Fact is that this is an issue that should be front and center for the legislature as the policymaking body of this state, setting up the criteria of which all state and local agencies will govern the privacy, keep and maintain the privacy information of our citizens. So I urge careful consideration, and hopefully we can put together a bill in the near future that will be something that we get broad support both by the public agencies, the citizens, and the legislature. So thank you very much. Any questions?
I just appreciate all the hard work you have put into this so far. Thank you, particularly Steve.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, obviously I thank you and Representative Huffman and Representative Williamson. I mean, I think it's been a really nice working with people who come from different backgrounds philosophically and come to the same conclusion that this is something that we really need to address as a legislature. So thank you very much.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for your testimony. Let's bring up Becky Strauss and Betsy Imholt.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Becky Strauss. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon, and I'm pleased to be here in support of this bill. Want to take a moment to recognize and appreciate the ongoing work of Chair Shields and Vice Chair George to advocate for the protection and advancement of privacy rights. It's critically important to the vitality of our constitutional rights, and particularly so as technology advances. It's well past time that our privacy laws are updated in accordance. Senator George, you mentioned the NSA revelations this June. They really absolutely sparked an important conversation nationwide, about how our government is accessing electronic communications content, location content, all sorts of things in terms of our communication, when we're having it and what we're saying. And I think that it renewed a conversation that we've been having at the local level to be asking those questions about our agencies here in Oregon. And I think that's what this bill is intended to do, is start to address some of those things. We obviously cannot control here in Oregon what the NSA is doing, but we can take a look at what our local law enforcement agencies are doing and what our local public bodies are doing. And I think that's the well-intended purpose of this bill. I'll just mention that the ACLU conducted a public records request of several, not all, local law enforcement agencies. I believe we sent out the request in 2011 and received a lot of the responses back in 2012. We've talked about that records request in the context of the license plate readers. We also queried law enforcement agencies on this issue. It's a little bit narrower than this bill, but we asked law enforcement agencies for local law enforcement agencies for their policies on location tracking, access to cell location data specifically, and what we found was that most agencies that responded didn't have a policy at all, but those that did not have a warrant requirement in place. And from our belief, it's really very important that we have that. What we're talking about here, and we've talked about it in past sessions, is updating our laws and to import those constitutional principles into an online world. In an offline world, there's no question, it's long established that law enforcement needs a warrant before they go into your home or your desk drawer, taking into account all sorts of exceptions like exigencies and emergencies and things like that. And it seems that this is the intention of this legislative proposal, to is make sure that it's clear that where I do my communication is not in written letters, but in emails and social media, and that that deserves the same constitutional protection under our state law. We really shouldn't have to choose between new technology and privacy, and I think that that's oftentimes the dilemma we're facing now. Again, in the context of the license plate reader, we've begun to talk a little bit about a privacy roadmap, and I think that it's very appropriate to talk about that privacy roadmap here. We are asking legislators to think about data collection, whether we're talking about medical records, student education records, government surveillance, whatever it is, really in the same light, because we're talking about the same type of thing. We're asking you to be asking these questions and addressing them in our statutes around usage. What type of information is being collected and by whom? Sharing and retention, who is it being shared with and how long is the information being kept? What type of control do the owners of that information, and by owners I mean the people whose information is being collected, what type of control do they have over that information? information, access to know that it's being collected at all or what is collected about them, and is the information being collected even accurate, accountability measures to make sure that privacy policies are in place, and that whatever data collection is happening is actually effective for whatever purpose it's being collected, and finally transparency so that we as the public know what type of collection is happening and what privacy policies are in place. Senate Bill 1583 does take a very smart approach to attempting to answer all of these questions and really addressing the pressing issues of our day. We appreciate the opportunity to talk about these concepts. We appreciate the fact that we are having this conversation in public hearing right now and are absolutely committed to working with stakeholders and senators and representatives alike to find a good policy moving forward.
Thank you, Betsy.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Betsy Eimholtz, and I'm with the Oregon Department of Transportation. Senate Bill 1583 impacts the department's programs for using roadside technology to provide drivers information about drive times through our use of variable message signs and also online services such as tripcheck.com. These tools are important both to drivers to allow them to give them choices about how to travel through the system, but also allows us to better manage the infrastructure that we have. The information that we use does not include personally identifiable information, and I don't believe is the target of this type of legislation. However, it does, this legislation does directly impact it. So just as we are with the license plate reader bill, we just look forward to engaging in this conversation in a meaningful way so that we can participate and be able to continue using the tools that we believe we need to use to manage the system effectively. And we just look forward to engaging that conversation when that and when the time takes place. Thank you.
Senator Miles Anderson.
I think maybe this is for Senator George. As a legislator, you know, a lot of our stuff is public record. And I try very hard to make sure that I have two computers. One is my personal and one is legislative. But with my phone, it gets a little bit tricky, because a lot of communication. So I'm just wondering where we come in with this bill.
I think public record laws are a different part of the statute and what this.
So it would be.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a different part. I mean, anything that's on your phone that has to do with legislative stuff, text messages stuff, would most likely be a searchable record. That's, I think, the big thing we talked about.
It's probably captured somewhere else in your other data. I mean, in the sense of onto your computer or something else, depending on how you got it linked.
Yeah. So, but I think that what this bill is aimed at is more like what agencies are doing out there. And we talked with ODOT about the idea is that, you know, you have databases that are going out there, and some of them may be acceptable, perhaps working with the truckers and those kind of things. But just broadly capturing data of people's movements, that type of information, being able to get people's emails, personal emails that are not public officials, they're just literally just citizens out there. Those things need to be closely monitored because the technology is going so fast on how quickly government can access personal information, not public officials' information, but our constituents' information.
And Betsy, I know you've been very helpful on the discussions with 1522 and that your concerns have been taken care of in those amendments. Do you still have outstanding concerns that haven't been taken into account on this particular bill?
Yes.
Okay.
Lots of work to be done on this bill, in my opinion.
Okay. All right, good. Anything else, Becky?
Not right now.
Not at this time. Okay. Let's see. Could we bring up Michael Slauson and Bob Russell and Daryl Fuller?
Good.
Sure. Thanks.
And Kevin Kemp.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Michael Slauson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Justice, and I'm here testifying on behalf of the Attorney General. As the Senate Bill 1583 is currently worded, the Attorney General opposes it. I want to talk about the reasons for that, and I'll start off with some big picture concerns. and then focus specifically on some very specific concerns. I don't intend to cover all of the concerns, just some big picture issues, and I've had a brief chance to look at some of the Dash 2 amendments that address some of the concerns I intended to talk about today. The first concern I was going to talk about is the obligation of public bodies to obtain a wiretap-like search warrant to obtain this information, be it the location information or the personal data. I know that there's an amendment there that puts a statutory mechanism for doing that, but there's one of the issues sort of inherent in this type of legislation is the practical impact that it will have. And so when you're thinking about in terms of warrants, if you're talking about regulatory agencies obtaining that information, that might make some sense or might be ways to make that work. But when you're talking about the entire breadth of this bill, when you're talking about water districts or school boards obtaining this type of information, that just doesn't make a lot of sense, practically speaking, how that would work. One other concern, kind of a big picture concern, too, is just what unintended consequences might be a part of this bill. And I don't want to go through point by point each piece of the bill, but just highlight one of them for you, which is pretty compelling for us, which is just the definition of location information. As it is currently worded, is so broad to refer to any information about a person's cell phone or electronic device that shows past or current locations. That's a telephone number. That's address on a phone bill. That's how broad the language is. And so part of the Attorney General's concern is that just that this discussion just needs to be furthered so that the stakeholders are required to implement it and this legislative body knows specifically what you're intending by passing this type of a bill. I also want to talk now briefly about how this bill relates to other existing obligations on government and other laws, and primarily this is a concern that's been brought up previously, but the Electronic Communications Privacy Act and the Stored Communication Act, both federal laws impose obligations on the government and restrict the access to information when it's stored with service providers. Now, I'm speaking mostly from a law enforcement perspective. That's my background. I've done online exploitation investigations for about 10 years. And so you know that from that perspective, this is not information that is generally stored by the government. It's information that's stored by service providers and the government then seeks access to. And the way that the ECPA and the SCA work is they employ a tiered approach. So essentially, the more private the information it is, the more process is required. So if we're talking about the content of an email, I want to know what emails you've sent on your Yahoo account. I'm going to need a warrant for that under the ECPA. If I want something, I just want to know whose account it is. I know it's, Mr. Jones at Yahoo.com, and I need to know who Mr. Jones is. I can get a subpoena for that information. And what's interesting about that process is even the subpoena under Oregon law has checks and balances on it. So to get a subpoena, if you're in a district attorney's office, you have to get 7 members of your community, of a grand jury, to authorize that subpoena. From the attorney general's perspective, there's a statute requirement to only obtain subpoenas for information that is relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation. So there's limitations already inherent. We talked about cell site data briefly. Under the ECPA and the SCA, to get cell site data, so that's cell tower location information about where towers were used to place a call or receive a call. Under federal law, you have to have a court order. You cannot obtain that with a subpoena. You have to have a court order, and that federal law applies equally to us. So whereas the federal law takes a tiered approach, this bill takes a sort of one-size-fits-all approach and treats all that type of information as the same, and it's just really not. There's very different privacy interests that attach to that different type of information. Another issue where this bill currently conflicts with Oregon law is Oregon law has a statute that discusses what law enforcement must do to obtain a warrant for purposes of cell phone tracking. We have a mobile tracking device statute currently that already covers that. That's found in ORS 133617 and 619. It's originally enacted to cover a tracking device that would be attached to a vehicle, but the definitions are broad enough to include a cell phone. And that's what most well, all as I know in my personal knowledge, law enforcement officers around the state use to track, as they use the authority under that statute. So however this comes out, there has to be some way of ensuring that we're consistent, because the obligations under that statute are very different under than they are would be under Senate Bill 1583. The other point I want to point out is kind of out of my arena is civil litigation. So a lot of the times in this information, a public body is participating in a lawsuit may get this information through the discovery process. This bill would prohibit that. Or potentially could, depending on its scope. So that's another consideration. So I bring those concerns to the committee's attention just because the sweeping nature of the bill is such that it requires pause to sort of assess exactly what is the total ramifications. And the final comments I want to make is about something that is of great import to the Attorney General, which is the online sexual exploitation of children, which is my background. Is I worked with the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, the Department of Justice, for about 10 years. I've now switched to the Appellate Division. But I want to tell you that protecting children from online exploitation is one of the Attorney General's top priorities. From my history, I can tell you that the biggest hurdle that we have is just simply resources. There are more predators out there than we can catch. There's just a lot of work out there. This bill, and the way that it is currently drafted, would further impede our efforts to go after those predators. And I'll talk briefly. There is a part of the Dash 2 amendment that covers it. One issue that comes up is the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force in the Department of Justice is federally funded. And part of that process is they have to respond to what are called cyber tips. And the cyber tips are part of a federal law process. But cyber tips come from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And we get federal money to respond and investigate those cyber tips. There's about 900 a year on average. I think last year it was 800. The year before that it was 1,500. And there's different things that can cause that to shift. You can have a lot of reports just on one person. And let me tell you about how those reports are generated most often. So the way the federal law is set up, it works with Internet service providers, other service providers. So they have a duty to report to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children any time that they have some information that a child has been exploited through the use of their services. Oftentimes, that comes up in situations in which somebody sends an email with maybe a known image of a child being sexually abused. So they snag that email, they send that information off to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. The National Center uses information within that email to identify where the person sent it from. It's called an IP address. And they can use that information because they're based regionally. And they can say, okay, that looks like that came out of Oregon. We're going to send that off to the Oregon ICAC. That's the acronym for the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. We're going to send it off to them and let them investigate that complaint. So that comes to us. Under the way the bill is originally drafted, we couldn't even receive that tip. We can't even get that tip because it contains location information. And location information in the IP address is often attendant to identifying the person.
Senator George. I appreciate this very long conversation about sex crimes and child abuse, but I want to point you at Section 4 of the original bill, and it's been strengthened in the Dash 2 amendments. It specifically says, specifically addresses all of the issues you just covered in the last 10 minutes, which is nothing in this act would prevent an agent of the Department of Justice from obtaining location information or personal electronic data in accordance with the subpoena process and in compliance with the Electronic Communications Privacy Act if the agent has reason to believe, just reason to believe, that the owner or the user of the cell phone or telephone device or the person who is subject to the personal electronic data is engaged in the violations of, and it goes through all of those ORS 163 violations that you've been talking about. So, I mean, I appreciate this conversation, except that that Section 4 basically makes the whole 10 minutes of last testimony. I don't quite understand why it's, but what's the issue?
Sure. Chair Shields, Senator George, I can respond to that directly because in this, that amendment highlights the very problem with trying to address the situation in the way that we have with this particular bill. Because what I was going to say is the ICAC not only does cyber tips, but they do other investigation. But those cyber tips, right, almost 900 on a year, are shepherded off to other law enforcement agencies to further process. So in other words, we process a lot of them, but there are so many of those that we work with and we train law enforcement agents throughout the state to process them in their local communities. And we do that by identifying which community they're in. So even though this amendment covers that, it doesn't address this other situation in which we're ferreting those out. And that's part of the problem, is when we don't have a complete understanding of the practical impact, the practical import of this legislation, we're going to cause some problems. The other part of it is some of those statutes that you've highlighted are not all of them. Those deal with the exploitation of children through imagery. There's other statutes involve online sexual corruption of a child, and when you communicate with a child. So you are trying to solicit a child for some sort of sexual activity online. That's another type of investigation the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force does. Another task force does that is called the Intercept Task Force. That's in the metro area. And so you have situations in which you might have a parent come to law enforcement and say, hey, somebody's trying to solicit sex from my child. So law enforcement in many situations will sit down and take over that child's identity and communicate with the predator. This bill would also prevent that type of investigation because, again, you're obtaining location information in every single one of those communications. Most online investigations at all, which are they're conducted by the ICAC, if they're conducted by local agencies who are also doing these types of investigations, all require some ability to identify who you're communicating with. If we don't know, you know, you think about the Internet, it's global. I don't know if you're in Oregon. I don't know if you're in Vancouver, Washington. I don't know where you are. Until I get that location information, I don't even know if there's a crime in Oregon to get a probable cause warrant. Those are just part of the big practical concerns with the legislation. Until we can get kind of everybody communicating, understanding how it actually works, the technology, those are the types of unforeseen consequences that might come about if we pass something like this.
So, yeah, what I thought I heard was it just the information coming into the state, because it had the locations in there, that under the original bill, it would not allow you to actually receive it, as compared to once you have it, then you can go through that process to get the warrant. But you have to have the ability to receive the information to do the initial processing before you can take these steps that apparently will be addressed in the amendment. That's at least what I thought I heard.
Chair Shields and Senator Prozanski, that's true. So when it comes into us, but then we have to do further. So the information comes in. What we will get is what is just the IP address. So then we have to find out who's the service provider who owns that IP address. And there's public web sites that allow us to identify that information. Anybody can enter an IP address and figure it out. So you find out, okay, so it's Comcast. So we send a subpoena to Comcast and say, somebody sent an email with this picture in it at this date and time. Who of your customers had that IP address at that time? And then they'll give us a name and address. Now, but your question presents a whole other problem. Assuming we can get that information in, putting the burden on these ICAC agents or the Intercepts agents then to go obtain a warrant is going to cut their ability to do their work in half. So even assuming that we could make the requisite showing that would be required by this bill, still the workload obligations would be such that we're not going to catch people that we otherwise are catching.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Who wants to go next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and we don't take a position on this bill. We would just very much like to be part of the conversation going forward, because we have been using these types of devices in providing the data to the government since the early 80s. And in all cases, it boils down to two things. All of our operating tax systems nationwide, essentially, are based on mileage. So we're collecting mileage information, and then the government uses that to verify that we've paid the correct amount of tax. The other area that they use it for is safety, to make sure that our drivers are driving within the allowable hours of service. So it's location and miles and all of that stuff. And we've been using different kinds of technologies for a very long time, for a couple of decades. we are currently using transponders that are on the trucks. You see the readers on the highway. They look like praying mantises hanging over the lanes. And they're actually scales in the highway that weigh the truck. It collects, identifies the truck, it collects the data, what time it's there, and that goes into ODOT's database. And then they come and they can use that data to make sure that we paid the taxes correctly and we're operating safely. They've also been using license plate readers, and I know that's a subject of another bill, but the reason I bring that up is working with Ms. Strauss, we've already got an exemption in that license plate reader bill for motor carrier regulation purposes, that they can use that those without a problem. That's a possible answer for us here. There's a couple of other systems that we're using. There's a New Zealand company by the name of E-Road that it's very much like a cell phone. It's a GPS-based system, and it captures everything. It goes to E-Road. They file our taxes, but all the data that they collect is also available to the Department of Transportation so that they can verify that we've done it correctly. That system was about a month and a half ago approved by Secretary of State Brown for use for those purposes in Oregon. Then the final thing is the federal government is about, and within the next 30 days, is going to issue a proposed rule that will require electronic onboard recorders in all trucks, and all of that data will be available to the regulators here at ODOT as well as the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, as we think it should be. So we just want to be sure that we're not precluded from continuing to do what we're doing, because it's far more efficient than the pen and pencil systems that we used in the past to collect our data to pay our taxes and the log books that we used for hours of service that sometimes we referred to as comic books with electronic recorders, that it's almost impossible to falsify the logs. And highway safety is our number one priority. So I'll stop right there and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Kevin.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. Obviously here to express concerns about the bill, which is not a surprise to committee members. We also recognize that this is a complex area, and we understand the heart of what's trying to be accomplished here. And we're also hopeful that we can continue to be a part of a conversation if this ends up being a longer, bigger conversation about updating our laws to reflect the new technologies. I did want to mention one comment. I know the time is short, and this isn't to the technical pieces of the bill, but more to our participation. As far as the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and some of our partner public safety agencies, over the last few sessions, we've been confronted with a number of different issues where we as a profession needed to take seriously or exhibit self-leadership in developing policies that address some concerns that were out there. I can give you a couple examples. One was missing persons, where some agencies didn't have solid missing persons policies. And it came out of the James Kim incident a few years ago where, you know, he was lost and ended up dying in the wilderness. It brought up a whole issue of how do we address missing persons. And then we addressed eyewitness ID concerns. How do agencies identify someone through use of lineups, and how do they talk to witnesses about who they believe committed a crime? And in order to demonstrate self-leadership, we put together a task force involving a wide range of folks, including sheriffs, police chiefs, district attorneys, our Oregon Accreditation Alliance, Department of Justice, and a number of others, DPSSD, to come to a conclusion, which we did. And hopefully, if you talk to people like Gail Meyer from OCDLA, that was very interested in us making progress in that area, I think she would say that we made a good faith attempt to do that. We're doing that with Brady issues right now. When officers are found to be untruthful, how do we manage that in terms of a solid policy? 45 separate people spent months working on that in order to show self-leadership. My concern with this bill is its complexity. But also the fact that I know Becky mentioned that she had done a survey of agencies to determine whether they had policies or not. And yet, the first time I really saw the bill was just a few weeks before the beginning of the session. And we would like to and feel like we've exhibited a desire and a willingness to sit down and really work through these things. So we would like to have that opportunity. We appreciate the opportunity this committee is providing to comment on the legislation itself, and we hope we'll have a chance to partner with you in trying to come up with both policies and language and statute that help address some of the privacy concerns that have been identified by the committee and others. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, gentlemen. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you very much.
Let's bring up David Gerstenfeld from the Employment Department.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. For the record, David Gerstenfeld, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance at the Employment Department. Just briefly wanted to echo the Employment Department's interest in participating in a discussion looking at this and make sure that the bill sponsors and legislators and people working on this are aware of the implications for tools that the Employment Department uses and potential tools out there for dealing with fraud and unemployment insurance benefit overpayments. That's an issue that we're very concerned about. The type of information that we typically look to is the IP address to see if people are out of the country when they're claiming benefits. So it's a different level of specificity than some of the other issues that have been mentioned. I just want to make sure that that's on the table when these discussions are being had.
Hadn't thought of that. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
All right, good. And could please bring up Gail Meyer, and this is the last person we have signed up.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'll be quick. I want to make a plug to this branch of government for you to please recognize your crucial role in this debate. Of necessity, the judicial branch will always be far behind these issues. And by that, I'm speaking now within the silo of the criminal defense adjudication world, because I know this bill has ramifications outside of that. But inside the world of adjudication of crimes, the judicial branch will always be far, far behind this. This will be some search and seizure occurring on some individual that you end up through adjudicating search and seizure law at the trial court level, will go up on appeal. It's always way behind. By the time the case of Kylo versus United States got to the United States Supreme Court about the use of photo red light technology to see heat emanating from inside a home, that technology was 7-8 years old, was almost irrelevant compared to what else was going on at the street level at that time. The executive branch of government, the police powers of government, its job is to go police us, and they do that job very, very well. And I agree with Mr. Campbell. Oregon stands out in terms of the law enforcement community being willing to check and balance themselves. But it is not their job to police themselves. It is their job to go police us. It is this legislative body's job to be in front of this issue. You really are the branch of government that can timely take a look at what's going on here and timely impose the limits by which law enforcement and the public bodies must comply and the freedoms available yet to the people. I'm going to make a plug on something that I've always wanted to make a plug on, and Mr. Elzinga is going to break into a smile. I know it. I would love for someone to really contemplate the creation of a commission, a task force, a legislative one, whose job it is to really monitor in real time what form of electronic surveillance or electronic data mining capturing tools is government using in a timely, real-time moment. So have it be an obligation where each public body or at least each state agency would have to inventory what kind of devices it uses, what does it do with that device, what kind of electronic data does it extract and retain, for what purpose, for how long. At least have it be fleshed out and transparent in real time so that at least the people can know. And this legislative body will know in real time what it is the agencies are doing. So with that, I just say thank you, Senator George. Thank you, Chair Shields, for sponsoring this bill and getting the conversation started. I think it's a very central one.
All right. Any questions for Gail? Okay.
Thank you.
Well, colleagues, I do think that this is going to need some more work. I would like to work with Senator Przanski, Senator George, and the other proponents to figure out what a good task force would be and who might be the conveners to head that up. So I think we had the option of sending this on to Judiciary. I think this one is not as far along as the bill that we'll hear next week, Senate Bill 1522. So we will not move it on today, but I appreciate all the work that's gone in so far. I think it's been a very good start, and we'll continue this throughout the interim. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1583, and we are adjourned.